Are you a thought leader or just a lousy thought follower? Join Johnny and Big Hungry in The Big Far Out, supported by the Freemasons Foundation.
Now, Jonathan Baker, what's you're obviously based at one of the two universities, AUT?
Or? I'm kind of at both.
Okay.
I'm a PhD researcher here at University of Auckland, and I have been working contracts at AUT, lecturing over there.
Okay. Now, what is your academic background?
So my background is quite strange, really. And it sort of is part of my academic background as well, because I actually spent 21 years as a musician in the Auckland Philharmonia Orchestra here in here in Auckland. I was the tuba player. And so I did a Bachelor of Music before that when I was, you know, in my late teens, and then went to the US and studied, and then came back for the job here in 93.
How does the transition go from trombone to
tuba
to market structures
to doing a PhD in market shaping? Yeah, so that's a good question. So
it's a gateway instrument.
Certainly not a gateway drug. So I spent 21 years playing in the orchestra, but the last 6 years of that I actually spent as the musician elected to the board.
Oh, cool.
And so I sat on the board of the orchestra. That was the experience I really loved. I was certainly sick of sitting next to trombonists by then. And, you know, the issues in the performing arts sector and so forth inspired me actually to quit my job and go off and do an MBA, which I did at AUT.
Let's go right back. What does that stand for? I feel like we've got to get all the things covered here. What's the MBA stand for? I don't know.
Master of Business Administration.
Thank you very much.
No problem. So
there's going to be a few dumb questions like that. Sorry, mate.
No. There's no dumb question.
Oh, great! I love it.
And so I went into the MBA thinking, okay, so the problems with the arts sector, you know, the fact that the performing arts sector around the world is shriveling up and dying, this is a managerial problem. I'm interested to pursue that. So that inspired me to go sort of do a managerial degree, which was the MBA. And then while I was doing the MBA, in the marketing papers I did, I got introduced to a particular theory that I found really inspiring. And I thought, wow, this would solve the problems of the arts sector. And that inspired me to start the PhD, and I started the PhD thinking that I was researching how to, you know, improve the marketing and the engagement of the performing arts sector with the community. And very shortly into the PhD, into my provisional year, I actually realized this isn't a marketing issue, this is actually a problem with the market. There is no viable market system for the performing arts here or anywhere else. Except, you know, a few little knots, say, in Berlin or something.
Is that because it kind of just evolved in a strange way and nobody's just gone, hey, this is how it should be, and everyone's just been, there's been a bit of freedom to the whole situation?
Like, no, I think it's actually the direct opposite of that.
Oh, really? Too much control?
Yeah. I mean, the performing arts is a field, not wanting to be too disparaging, because I think, you know, some of the greatest art of that humankind has produced is sitting in the performing arts, but unfortunately the organisations and the repertoire and so forth just did not continue to evolve.
Right.
And so the way the organisations engage with the community, it's always relied on this, you know, almost this system like kings and dukes and so forth, you know, this very strange old-fashioned way of thinking that what we do is really, really valuable, therefore people should engage with us, and if people don't engage with us, then the problem is with the people.
I see.
So as I was saying, you know, I started the PhD and realized that actually what needed to happen here with performing arts was a whole market system needs to be created, and as a result of that line of research that sort of evolved during my provisional year, I ended up leaving the performing arts as my context behind altogether and just started looking more generally at how markets are shaped and how markets are created and disrupted.
If you're going like big picture, what sort of market are we existing in at the moment?
Yes, so that's So that's a really important question because
one of the
big problems is that people don't define what is a market. Mm. And most businesses think of a market as something, as either a marketplace where they try to sell their wares and distributors and retailers and so forth, or they think about it as a group of customers. The perspective that I've taken when I look at a market is to think of it as a complex system that includes the customers, includes the marketplaces, includes the industry, the value chain, the supply chain, and so forth. So all of those elements come into scope when I'm looking at markets. And so, the problem, of course, is that most businesses, they define a market by the product that they sell. You know, oh, we're in the mobile phone market, or they define it by the industry. Oh, we sell into the electricity market. But in actual fact, people don't buy, they don't buy a smartphone because they want a smartphone. They buy a smartphone because of what a smartphone offers them through time, right? Every iPhone is identical, but every iPhone is also unique because what we do with the iPhone...
My apps.
It's different experience.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so, and that's what we're after. We buy products. You know, we buy a glass because we want something that we're going to drink water from. We don't want to buy a glass for the sake of buying a glass. Mm-hmm. So every product is actually a provider of service. And so when you define a market by the product or the industry, you actually miss the entire point of why you're operating in the market, which is actually to be delivering value in an ongoing fashion to your customers and other actor groups.
Okay.
I'm really trying hard to make this kind of interesting.
As simple as but what is kind of baffling me, I don't know, I've got obviously kind of a simple grasp on it, but
don't put yourself down.
It seems like there's a huge amount of factors at play, and if you are going to, so you're looking at the market and you want to make changes in it, where do you start with these changes?
Yeah, well, you know, it depends. Mm. You look at technology. I mean, technology is one of the surest, a great technology is one of the surest ways that you can massively shape a market. Mm. So obviously the smartphone, you know, in 2005, if you said to someone, so how many people are in the smartphone market and how many handsets are we going to sell? Well, the smartphone didn't actually exist. Mm. So the smartphone market itself didn't exist. People didn't know they needed a smartphone. And now you look at just a few years later and people just couldn't live without them.
It's almost like it was coined after the fact, though. It was like your phone just got the internet and then it evolved in its own way, and all of a sudden that smartphone, I'm not sure who first used that term, but it's almost like it was coined by the public, not by the people that are actually selling.
That's a great point, yeah. And a lot of products and product categories themselves are things that evolve over time as different groups sort of share knowledge and talk to each other and share experiences. There's a great case study that someone did some years ago looking at the minivan in the United States and how the minivan category previously didn't exist. What is this, a car or a van, or what is this thing? Yeah. And so the minivan is a product category.
To get soccer moms.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And now you look at it, you think of
I can't drive a van, but a minivan.
but now there's all these vivid images, right, around the minivan, just like there's vivid images around the smartphone. Yeah. And you look at something like, you look at online video streaming. Mm. You know, you think about the fact that a cable TV provider, how they defined their industry or their market. You think about broadcast networks around the world, how they defined their market. And you look at the sheer amount of disruption now brought about by Netflix and Amazon Prime and so forth. So it completely has changed what we think is television consumption, the device, the size of the screen, the ability to binge watch, the ability to be able to have personalized accounts and so forth. Mm. So technology is a great way, you know, that we can shape a market, but of course not everyone is Apple, not everyone is Netflix. So there's other ways we can shape markets too. So say you look at the discontinuation of single-use plastic bags here in New Zealand. Well, okay, so the government now sits back and they say, oh, well, we're going to ban these things. But the supermarkets did that voluntarily. But why did they do it? Because people pressured them. Greenpeace pressured them. Mm. Other environmental groups pressured them. And so it's all these factors that go on that shape markets.
It must be, just with markets and like following how things are going, it must be heaps of... You must have to watch a lot of surveys and stuff because it's constantly changing. You know, a lot of like statistics and stuff like that of just... You must have to crunch through all that kind of stuff quite fast because that's, imagine like, it's probably more of from a company point of view to improve their product. They must be like just survey to keep up with what people kind of want to stay in touch with.
Yeah, but again, you get into that problem of you first of all got to define what it is that you think that you're doing. Mm-hmm. Who is it that you're competing and who is your customer and what is it that you do for them? So firms are very busy, filled with very, very busy managers who are setting about trying to, you know, trying to measure and segment their market and all these sorts of things. But in actual fact, what they do before they do that is that they bring a mental model to the equation and they say to themselves, oh, so this is my industry, these are my competitors and these are my customers. So they see the market as something that's, to use a horrible word, exogenous to them, something that exists out there. Mm. But in actual fact, every single manager, every time they stand there or they sit there at their desk and they do some sort of analysis, they actually create the market in their mind.
Right. But fascinatingly, also, they're in the market too, you know?
Yeah, so they are.
It's really trippy when you think about it like that.
Yeah. And they perform the market.
Right.
Right. The way they measure it and segment it, the way they approach it and the way they conceptualize of that market, they create the market, they perform the market, and everyone in their organization does it at the same time. And it's when you get these firms that completely reevaluate, so what is it that we do and for whom do we do it, that's when you get these amazing changes taking place.
Okay. Now, obviously, it seems everything is very technology-driven and driven by globalization and the sharing of ideas, and it seems to be happening more and more rapidly. At what point do we need to step back and go, hey, the market... shouldn't have unfettered, you know, like be driven completely by technology and globalization. At what point do you start legislating in the market?
Ooh.
Yeah, well, that's
nobody wants to be told what they want or anything like that.
Yeah, but it has to happen.
Yes, yeah.
Right? Because we're in a terrible state.
We can't be trusted.
We can't be trusted. Right? And I mean, as much as we can't be trusted, the shareholders on Wall Street, they certainly can't be trusted. And so for me, that's where my research is leading. One of the things I'm really interested to research further on is how is it that we can shape these markets that actually deliver what we call pro-social outcomes, outcomes that are actually beneficial to society.
But does that have to... I'm just making the money sign to you now, Jonathan. Does that have to align at some point with the money when it comes to the corporations and stuff? Like, surely it has to come from the government almost for them to go, hey, nah, it's not about the money this time.
Well, you look at the role of an organisation like Greenpeace in single-use plastic bags here in New Zealand, right? So, I think because markets are these incredibly complex systems that have all of these constituent parts, in actual fact, it is... around collaboration and cooperation that we're going to get the change. And the one place actually that we see market shaping working really well is with the Global Fund. And the Global Fund is this organization. I don't know that much about it, to be honest, but I think it's part of the UN. And what they have done is they have brought together organizations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and big pharmaceutical companies and other funders and all these sorts of parties. They've brought them together to work out how it is that we can incentivize big pharma to produce pharmaceuticals to go to the developing world. And that's worked extremely well. They, you know, the Global Fund, they have this market shaping strategy. It's worked really well. And the way they've done that is to create this cooperation and collaboration. So in actual fact, when you look at markets not as these competitive arenas where everyone's kind of duking it out, instead if we look at it as a way for people to come together and co-create value and to engage in exchange, then from there, what is it that we can build?
Can these sort of ideal markets exist within a capitalist framework?
Yeah, that's a good question, and that's something that I struggle with all the time. You know, as part of my teaching, I teach I've taught quite a lot around social enterprise. So organizations that are profit-driven but are there to deliver positive social outcomes. And so there's lots of great examples of some social enterprises around, you know, Eat My Lunch and Better World Books and organizations like this. But when all said and done, are we going to invent a social enterprise that is going to address child abuse or domestic violence, right? So, yeah, exactly, the wicked problems. And so, although I think there is definitely space for social enterprise, we also need to protect things like the nonprofit sector. We also need to protect the ability of governments not to be corrupted, not to be corrupted by Wall Street, not to be corrupted by all sorts of other elements, lobbyists and so forth. And governments have to be able to regulate, and they have to be able to regulate for the betterment of a society. And so as much as, you know, that we've got concern around unfettered capitalism, there's also, for me, a lot of concern around the drive for smaller government. Because, you know, it's a complex system. We need to have regulators. We need to have firms. Because, you know, markets are wonderful things. They generate wealth. They incentivize entrepreneurial activity. Where would we be today without markets, you know? I mean, we'd all still be stuck in the Soviet Union wearing overalls.
Are there any countries out there which are, you know, we could look towards as an example of, you know, striking that balance
who's
between control
ass?
And
what's a kick-ass market structure at the moment?
Well, what I would, in my experience, I mean, as far as my own personal experience, I look to Germany, and I've spent quite a lot of time in Germany now, and done some teaching there. And for me, the way the Germans have balanced incentivizing business at the same time as making sure that you have got bureaucracy, and not bureaucracy in the negative way, but bureaucracy in the fact that you have regulations and organization and so forth. So the way they create that balance there, I think, is really, really impressive. I haven't got first-hand experience, but I look at economies, you know, the typical ones, Finland, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, and you look at those sorts of economies. But they're changing, you know. We see this uprising of you know, the far right and so forth, and those economies, they're not immune to that kind of behaviour, which is really, really concerning. And the same in Germany with the Alternative for Deutschland party. So, yeah. I don't know. I don't know how rosy it is. But I think from my experience in Germany, I'm very impressed with that society. But I'm the kind of person that likes trains to run on time. So.
Yeah. is there any sort of wrap-up conclusion punchline that you'd offer us on market structures, or anything that we might want to think about in the broader sense, or what we should really take away when we're thinking about market structures?
I guess for me... It's this sort of systemic perspective, looking at market structures and realizing that although I think we can feel like we're buried in this sort of neoliberal capitalist kind of environment, in actual fact, there's all sorts of examples, great examples of different market actors that are influencing and shaping and changing markets. And I think, too, from a firm perspective, I think what the firms really need to think really carefully about is how it is they define what it is that they do and for whom do they do it.
Mm. Such a big responsibility, isn't it?
Yeah.
Making something that might end up, you know, like a smartphone or whatever, that ends up being so reliable for so many people.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, delivering so much value every day, right? Mm. And so the thing with firms is that what we see happening with the large corporations around the world is they're being driven towards short-termism, trying to, you know, work on a quarterly basis to generate as much dividend as possible to the shareholders. And when we look at examples of market shaping that have been successful, they've taken years, right? Sometimes they've taken many years. And the corporations of today are not taking that perspective, certainly not in the Western world. They're incentivized instead to be delivering capital value back to their owners.
Do you think it's going to be possible to make that shift to making, you know, that making the long-term shift and making better quality products that have a longer lifespan? It just seems like people aren't interested in that these days.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And again, it comes down to what is it that, you know, when it comes to a particular product, and when we remember a service is a product as well, but when we think about a good that's being manufactured, if you approach it from the perspective of delivering value to someone in use over time, then in actual fact, what we want to be delivering to people is a long time with good use, right? So if we were to sort of shift towards more of this sharing economy type situation, where people are sharing, you know, houses and cars and scooters and all these sorts of things, that, you know, you look at something like Lime Scooters here in Auckland, you look at the market shaping that they've done in a very short period of time. You know, what is Lime Scooters? They're incentivized because they produce something that they want people to use over a long period of time. They're actually incentivized to produce a great product that's going to be really sturdy, is going to deliver to its purpose, and is going to do it for a long period of time. And so it's going to be interesting to see, as we see more and more sharing, so people are buying access to goods, it'll be interesting to see how that incentivizes the producers to produce things that are going to deliver this value over a long period of time.
Right on. Jonathan Baker, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you for coming in after hours.
No problem at all.
95 BFM, the big fire up, supported by the Freemasons Foundation.